Just a quick note, looking ahead, recognizing that Dr. Rust has limitations on his schedule and thinking that we'd go as long as we can before we try and take a lunch break, but recognizing that the local cafeteria closes at 2:30, our thought was that we might try and break about 1:45 for lunch. So those of you who have more accurate timepieces might want to try and flag my attention as we're getting close. And just to be put on alert about that's our preliminary thought for schedule.
Okay.
Ms. Esposito, to continue your direct examination.
Dr. Rust, we're going to move to slide number 41. I believe you had a brief comment about the hyperactivity note at the bottom of this slide.
Yes. Again, I've said perhaps too much about systems, but these are some examples of them. And these kinds of behaviors that we see that are so very peculiar in children with autism are things that that an inexperienced observer might mistake as hyperactivity, anxiety, other kinds of things. I've already mentioned that issue of label, and I think it's important to bring this up within the context. I'll be commenting on Dr. Kinsborn's report, but there is a considerable emphasis placed on these as manifestations of a hyperexcitable state in the nervous system, and I simply say that it doesn't make sense to me to put things together in that way. It's certainly not in keeping with the data that I'm aware of or my experience in the clinic with considerable numbers of patients. And these kinds of behaviors, as I already mentioned, melt away so dramatically in the setting of families that show understanding and educational settings. And yet some things persist. They need to be separated from one another. To call them something, whether it's anxiety, hyperactivity, hyperexcitability of the brain, is far beyond what we know about these things.
We're going to skip a few slides, but we'll move up to slide number 45. Can you explain to me what this is? It says to whom it may concern.
The preceding slides concerned some of these peculiarities of behavior with the emphasis on how these are almost certainly systems-related things, differences of behavior. If children with autism were most of the people in the world, we might look peculiar in that setting, but nonetheless, this is the way things are. Because of these things, because of lack of understanding, when I see a family with a child with autistic features, I give them this card, and this is so they can show this card to people in the supermarket, or they can show it to Uncle Ed, or they can show it to whoever it is that tells them they don't understand how to care for their child, because it's important to know that all of us have difficulties understanding autism, and it's important to know that people sometimes try to intervene in children with autism and not understand what they're doing, so this is what this card is all about.
Excuse me, just a question for counsel and for the special masters. Are the slides that are being skipped, are they being withdrawn from the exhibit, or how are we handling
this? I certainly have questions on some of them that I intend to go back to, if that helps you.
Okay. And I would, too. That's why I just wanted to get clear that what we see here as this exhibit, even though it's being perhaps skipped on direct testimony, is remaining in the on the record, and there's an opportunity to cross on this.
Yes.
We'll move now to slide number 49. We talk about methylmercury intoxication. Can you explain to me what we see in methylmercury intoxication?
Yes, we have a good deal of information about methylmercury because of the tragic experience in... Could we go to slide 48, actually?
48, okay.
Yeah. We know about this condition because it was so carefully studied pathologically, clinically, and in all other ways. This is a young child that had methylmercury intoxication. This, as was typical in these cases, was a disease that occurred prenatally, thought to be the case because of the concentration of methylmercury being much higher in the fetus than it was in the mother, with observations that the pregnant mothers of children in Minamata Bay were not affected by the methylmercury intoxication in the same way other individuals that were not pregnant were. And the tragic consequence, despite the fact that the mother didn't have disease, was a child with severe neurologic disease. Children, as in this instance, cared for by their mother throughout their ensuing life.
And Minimata, was that a congenital mercury exposure?
This was, again, the children that manifested this condition were fetuses during the period that they were exposed. And again, the thought is that the fact that the mothers were less likely to have poisoning and manifestations was because of concentration of the toxin in the baby. This suggests to us, for which there is additional evidence, that a very high dose was necessary, that a mother could be protected, yet exposed to the same waste material that had the methylmercury, as long as the toxin was concentrated in another individual. And the fact that this affected children in the prenatal environment as compared to children that were post-birth, again, is interpreted as because of concentration. So people do have some ability to withstand this toxin unless exceedingly high concentrations are achieved.
I think on slide 49 you describe what methylmercury intoxication actually looks like.
The clinical aspects of it are these. Severe visual and hearing deficits, as I mentioned. These are not features of autism. Severe central nervous system motor dysfunction, not a feature of autism. In fact, motor function in autistic individuals is oftentimes quite dramatically excellent. Severe peripheral nervous system sensory dysfunction, not a feature of autism. And limb deformities, not a feature of autism.
Slide number 50, the pathology from Minimata Bay.
Almost exactly the opposite of what we see in autism. The large neurons that seem to be less well represented in autism are spared, as are the deeper cortical laminae. This is not, as I was trying to emphasize in the preceding slides, an example of systems dysfunction or remodeling. It's a matter of toxicity, and we don't see the same systems problems. We see the central nervous system relatively spared because of blood-brain barrier, and the deficits tend to involve peripheral nerves more. Sparing of Purkinje cells, very importantly, which we know are exquisitely sensitive, seemingly, in autism. This is despite a relatively uniform distribution of mercury in the brain.
So. Let's move to slide number 51.
So if an injury is produced to the brain, as is suggested in these cases, by inorganic mercury, the pathology and the dose required, one must presume, to be exactly the same as that in these methylmercury intoxications, if the emphasis is placed, as it appears to be in Dr. Kinsborn's discussion, on inorganic mercury and its accumulation in the brain, because both methylmercury and ethylmercury break down to inorganic mercury. There is a small difference in terms of concentration that is nothing like the difference in concentration that's observed in Minimata Bay disease, where prenatally the children seem preferentially to accumulate mercury.
Dr. Russ, we're going to move now to a discussion of the two children in these cases. We'll start with William Mead, and we're going to break from your slideshow for the time being. Do you agree that William Mead has autism?
Well, yes, ma'am.
In your opinion, was William's autism caused or contributed to by his receipt of thimerosal-containing vaccines?
No, ma'am.
Can you explain that?
I've tried to explain it in the preceding information. He doesn't have a disease that has the clinical aspects of mercury intoxication. It's a disease that has all of the features and manifestations that we know in autism and find in great measure in Rett syndrome that we know is a genetic disease.
In your report on William Mead, you discussed the significance of, and in your testimony earlier today, you discussed the significance of William Mead's enlarged head circumference. And there was an issue last week as to the citation for that head circumference. I'd just like to clear that up with you at this time. The reference in your report was William Mead Exhibit 3 at page 34. And this is what's on the screen right now. Can you tell me what this exhibit is?
That's a representation of length and head circumference, and it I thought was at birth.
Okay, and let's look at William Mead Exhibit 1 at page 4. Can you tell me what this is?
I apologize for the error of citation, but this is the important illustration of head circumference crossing centiles. This is quite unusual during the first 3 or 4 months of life. In that, that's right. And then a little bit further, we need some more information. No, that's there we go. Okay.
So what we've blown up here is the head circumference over the first few months of life.
This is what I believe I represented in my report. The 60th rising to the 97th percentile, something like that, and then declining thereafter.
Now, Dr. Mumper had suggested that William's large head size was just in correlation with the size of his body, that he was just a large baby. As a pediatric neurologist, is that your understanding of what happened here?
No, ma'am. We see the correlation between, we see this rise being out of proportion to the increase in the linear growth of the child.
Is there a point on William's growth chart for his head size that's particularly telling to you?
The high point, these charts, if people are not used to looking at them, represent centiles for growth parameters. And we use these as things that may help us to detect the cause of a problem. But in addition to the increase, the even more telling aspect of this is the ensuing decline, because there isn't anything that can compress the head and cause this change as time goes on. We see rather an initial increase with the ensuing decline in size, suggesting that something developmentally has gone on. If one were to have a hemorrhage or hydrocephalus, one would see further increase, and it's this decline that takes place afterwards is the thing that we see in children with autism in the first year of life.
And by decline, you mean that William's head circumference came back towards the mean?
As you can see, it continues to grow, but the rate of growth violates the centile.
Okay.
And that is represented by the circles.
By the circles, yes.
That are on the arms.
Yes, Special Master.
Thank you.
Dr. Russ, did you find any significance to William's numerous sicknesses during his first few years of life?
They didn't seem to me to differ in any quantitative way from other children. Is there a specific you'd like to ask me about?
Just the round of antibiotics. I believe in your report you stated that there were 6 rounds of antibiotics that William was on in the first, I believe you said, from 1998 to 1999. There may have been prescriptions for more, and I believe Dr. Mumper had said that there were 9 antibiotics given in the first 2 years of life. If it were 9 or even a few more than that, would that be unusual in your opinion?
Based on the clinical descriptions and based on what we know about variation in practice in the community, very little can be made of the number of antibiotics given for what are largely or perhaps entirely viral illnesses. Ear infections come from a variety of causes, but almost all are viral. Some practitioners will provide more antibiotics and some will provide less for those things. Some don't provide any at all. So the comparison of children getting more or less antibiotics is a parameter we can't interpret because it's based so much on the practice of an individual, and because we know that most of these illnesses are viral and not responsive to antibiotics. That's what I'd say about that.
Now, Dr. S., you had already discussed pica a little bit. There's some evidence in the record, both from the medical records filed and from Mr. Mead's testimony last week, that William may have put marbles, gravel in his mouth and had some other, there's some other mention of pica in the record. Do you find that significant in his case?
As I mentioned, these peculiarities of mouthing objects and putting them in the mouth or rubbing them on the lips are very common in autism. But we do find the same things in some otherwise normal children.
Dr. Russ, from your review of the records, is there any evidence that the biomedical interventions performed on William treated his autism?
No, there's no evidence that there was an effective treatment provided.
And we'll go through some of those in a few minutes. In Dr. Mumper's report, she infers that William's teeth grinding is a sign of mercury intoxication. What significance do you place on the teeth grinding?
We have a fancy name for it. We call it bruxism. Bruxism is so characteristic of Rett syndrome as to be almost universal. In autism, we see that very commonly, and we don't know the significance of it, but we find it far more often in autism than in some other settings. It's not a sign, to my knowledge, of mercury intoxication.
Dr. West, I'm going to ask you to spell your fancy name.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I hope I can. Bruxism.
Thank you.
We're going to move now to some of the facts specific to the Jordan King case. Do you agree that Jordan King has autism?
Yes, ma'am.
In your opinion, was Jordan's autism caused or contributed to by his receipt of thimerosal-containing vaccines?
No, ma'am.
And is your reason the same as what you gave earlier?
Yes, ma'am.
There was an issue last week, again, with the citations in the records that I'd like to clear up regarding a record which documented the timing of Jordan's loss of speech. In your report, it notes that the father, Jordan's father, was the historian. And the record that you cited to was Exhibit 7, Jordan King Exhibit 7 at page 8. This is what you see on your screen right now, and Mrs. King actually came back and testified about this being her notation. I'd like to draw your attention now, Dr. Russ, to Jordan King Exhibit 1 at page 41. Is this the record you meant to refer to when you described that Jordan's father had said that Jordan's speech had stopped around 1 year?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you find anything aside from this record that included some description from Jordan's father? Did you find anything else concerning in the record about Jordan's speech?
At this moment, I don't recall whether there was something else. Did I cite something else?
I'm not sure if you did or not. I think the you stated earlier today that Jordan only had 5 words, and I think from his mother
it could have been 6. I think it said, but
it could have been up to 10 from his mother's testimony last week. Is that what you would expect in a child who stopped speaking at 18 months, 5 or 10 words?
No, I think that there's abnormality. That's why I mentioned the fact.
Would you expect more words from a child who's?
I think the most important thing here is that there's a mention that he's stopped communicating. It isn't the number of words. We have all of us certain interpretations of things a child may mean to say. But the important thing is that the mention is of a change in his communication by the person who knows him best.
There are some notes in the record that Jordan was never a people person, and he was never an "I want to be held" baby as early as 3 months. Is that significant to you in terms of his autism?
We take that quite seriously when we hear about it.
You mentioned earlier that some children with autism have splitter skills that are unusual. According to the record, did you find any of those splitter skills in Jordan King?
There is a mention of the very thing that it seems to me the sense of direction part of this was mentioned in the record. I believe I recall that. And musical abilities were also mentioned. These are fairly common areas of attainment in.
Is that the type of skill that would be present in someone with mercury intoxication?
As I mentioned, the hallmark includes hearing problems and motor skill problems, and these were not manifested by Jordan King.
There was an amino acid analysis used by Dr. Green. This would be Jordan King Exhibit 1 at page 12 and 13. Can you tell if Jordan had an amino acid disorder?
Can I see the record?
We're going to pull it up for you here.
Is this the... There's no data here on amino acids, so.
I think this is just Dr. Green's discussion of it.
When it's suggested there's an amino acid disorder, we of course always check the results of the amino acids that have been obtained in blood and urine.
And you stated in your report that looking at those records, Jordan has no evidence of a known amino acid disorder.
That's quite correct.
Okay. Does it appear to you that Jordan, through your review of the records, that Jordan had any evidence of pancreatic dysfunction?
I didn't see any evidence of pancreatic dysfunction.
Did you review the results of the various mercury tests performed on Jordan King?
Yes, I did.
What, if anything, can you conclude from them?
Mercury testing done in normally accredited laboratories was always either quite normal or in fact, nothing at all was found. So, quite normal results.
The other laboratories that did some of the tests on Jordan King, in your report, I believe you said that there were astonishing levels of various metals in the lab results. This would be Jordan King Exhibit 1 at page 55 was the exhibit. What do you find significant on this page if you were to accept these results?
Well, this and other records show remarkable elevations of a broad variety of compounds, including metals, at concentrations that we would be very worried about the expression of the diseases that are known to be associated with those kinds of things. And it would raise the question as to how in the world this child might have acquired that much in the way of these compounds. There are many things in the environment, but we do heavy metal screening on lots of children for various reasons, and we never find anything like this except in rare instances. I can't quite read this, but it seems tin, for example, is shocking. There is a tin intoxication. It's seen almost exclusively in people who spend their careers for long periods of time working with tin, and tin that becomes inhaled, especially when people are working on tin with hot torches and this sort of thing. It takes a long time to happen. It's a mid-career thing in people that get this. And children absorb tin if they can get at it very poorly. Tin has the advantage from a standpoint of intoxication of having a taste that people don't like. And so I think people wouldn't be likely to put this in their mouth. So.
And I take it you saw nothing in the records aside from this result that would make you think Jordan King had a tin intoxication?
No, ma'am.
I'd like to move now to the treatment of autism. From your experience, are there any treatments that seem to improve symptoms in autism?
Yes, as I mentioned, proper understanding, improvement of sleep. Sometimes we can help out with medications for other specific indications as long as we're very, very careful about the dose, because I mentioned the sensitivity to medications. And as long as we check very carefully afterwards to make sure we've achieved an effect, there's an opportunity in children with these kinds of problems to multiply medications in ways which we then can't sort out disease from toxicity. And what I tell the families when we try something is we do one at a time, and then the family takes a close look. If it looks like it's not causing any problems, we increase the dose gradually so that we don't, again, complicate things. And there's such variation in behavior in children with autistic diseases that that we have to be very careful as to what the background is. Children tend to come to us when they're having more problems. Family wants us to help. We give something and they get better. And we may try to take credit for it, but behavior and many other manifestations of this disease, as with human behavior in general, typically follows what we call a sine wave. A sine wave, as you recall, is this thing goes up and down and up and down like this. And for all of us, things get better and things get worse and things get better and things get worse. When things are better, it's fine. If things get worse, we do something. If it gets better, maybe it's Mother Nature doing that. Often it is. So we need to be very careful about that in confusing us. And then to decide whether something's really helping after the family has looked so very carefully, and sometimes other people, what I tell the families is nothing should be continued unless you suddenly say, I wish we'd done this before, because it made such a difference. And from our vantage point, when we see children that have been treated in various ways, we can sometimes get a sense of that as well. So does that answer your question?
I believe it does. Can you extrapolate from a seemingly successful treatment to a causative factor for the underlying autism?
No, I don't think so, not in my understanding of this disease process.
I'd like to discuss some of the treatments that have been administered to the two children in these cases and check to see your understanding of the efficacy of these treatments for autism. Both of the children received IVIG therapy. Is that known to treat or help autism?
It's been tried, as has its cousin, corticosteroids. Typically, they're tried in the setting of EEG abnormalities. We've had the opportunity to closely observe children treated with both forms of therapy without any evidence of improvement behaviorally or functionally or from the vantage point of EEG.
Both of the children in this case were also on supplements. Have you seen anything that indicates that supplements improves autistic symptoms?
I'd have to provide a very general statement, but there are so many supplements. We don't hear about most of them, probably. We don't hear about when they started or stopped most of the time. So I can't say for certain. We don't have as close an opportunity to observe. To the extent that there is data and to the extent to which families will share with us what they've been doing, we haven't seen any efficacy for many different kinds of supplements, but I don't know whether we've seen the whole list or not.
What about secretin?
Secretin has been subjected to a very careful study to see whether it's efficacious and was found not to be efficacious. It's a compound that continues to be studied, and perhaps additional information will be found.
What about chelation?
I've seen no evidence that chelation is helpful in this setting. It is helpful in some other settings. It's helpful in the case of lead intoxication at higher degrees. As an older pediatrician, when we used to see more lead intoxication than we do now, and as my clinics were oftentimes on Fridays, had some experience with the considerable pain that children would experience with chelation typically. So we'd always know that the chelation clinic was open because children would be screaming on their way into the chelation. It did help somewhat with lead, and that's why it was carried on, and helps with copper as well. But in the setting of autism, I've seen no evidence that it's efficacious, and wouldn't expect for it to be efficacious because it's not pertinent to the disease. There have been 4 deaths at least from chelation therapy, and that's probably what makes me a little irritable about the subject, as in addition to the pain it causes the children.
Have you heard of a therapy putting a child in a sauna to sweat it out? Does that help the symptoms of autism?
It's been around since ancient times, that approach to things, in all cultures, and with the idea that it might be helpful, whether in the sweat lodge or in whatever. And it does seem to be helpful to some individuals with headaches. It helps some individuals with stress and tension. I see no reason why it would help in autism because there's nothing to sweat out, except perhaps some of the notions and treatments that are provided to the child.
I'd like to direct your attention now to William Mead, Exhibit 15 at page 28. This is a treatment note from Dr. Green. There's a note here that Dr. Green was looking at the possibility of doing a re-implantation enema, ideally with a colonic delivery system using a diluted maternal fetal supernate. Are you aware of that as a treatment for autism?
I'm aware that it's provided to some children with autism.
Are you aware of its efficacy?
So far as I know, there is no known efficacy. There's no reason to anticipate that it would, because there's no known element of the pathophysiology of autism to which it would address itself. The approach has been around for a long time. It goes back to Roman times, as a matter of fact, for a broad variety of illnesses. It continues to be practiced regularly by some adults as well as other people in those settings. We don't have any reason to believe it's going to be helpful in any particular disease. It used to be a regular feature of childbirth with the idea that the introitus might be wider. Some mothers were subjected to enemas for that purpose. Once it was studied carefully and found to be a silly idea, it was abandoned. So that's been true of the other indications as well.
What about the possibility of feeding a child fermented vegetables? This is further down on that same exhibit, William Mead, exhibit 15 at 28.
Fermented vegetables are an item of the diet in large parts of the world and is said to be enjoyed by people as well. Their benefits are unknown. When you do ferment vegetables, you do have the possibility of introducing organisms. The fermentative solution is like that. Sometimes this can be beneficial, and sometimes it can be a negative thing. So many people in the room will have enjoyed and perhaps obtained some benefit from fermented hops as beer, other people wine, and so forth. It also can be something that in excess and can be a problem. So we've seen it go both directions. I know no reason why this would have anything whatsoever to do with autism.
And further down on that, and it's still highlighted there as well, earthworm eggs. Is that known to treat autism with any success?
No known benefit that I'm aware of. The Chinese botanical is interesting. We had a patient that came to us with difficult epilepsy, and a Chinese botanical was introduced, and we were astonished to see how beneficial it was in this child's epilepsy. So we thought we were onto something. We sent it to a laboratory and had it analyzed. It was phenobarbital.
What about charcoal capsules? Is that something that's been known to help in the treatment of autism?
The same general idea about charcoal, of course, is leaching something out of the system. I don't have any reason to know that would be beneficial in autism.
What about oral Bagam, which is an immune globulin? Do you know if that is used to treat autism?
I have no information whatsoever about that substance.
What about Valtrex, a medication?
I don't know any reason that it would be helpful here in autism.
Are you familiar with Eskimo oil?
I don't know what you mean by that. I have no idea. Valtrex is used for genital herpes, isn't it? I don't know why it would be beneficial in this setting.
Have you heard of Actos?
No.
For the treatment of autism?
No.
If there were a report of improvement after these treatments, would you extrapolate from that to a cause of the child's autism?
If we definitely saw an improvement, I'd try to sort out what had happened. First, you have to know what's being treated, and secondly, you have to know whether anything else has been involved there, and then you have to decide what the mechanism is and then study it. So theory is one thing and observation is one thing, and once we get a hold of something that looks like it's promising, it has to be subjected to experiment so that we can really understand what's going on. It needs to be extended to a broader population oftentimes to really see what's going on. As I mentioned, all of life follows a sine wave, up and down and up and down. So.
Is it standard practice for a physician to recommend a product to patients and then personally sell it to them?
In my experience, this is considered to be one of the most important violations of the oath and the responsibilities that we take as physicians. We are there to help the sick, to listen without repeating their complaints. And the idea that somehow we would keep an office full of Amway products or something and sell them to our patients would be, for most of us, considered a grave violation of our responsibilities and taking a grave advantage of patients, because it trades in that setting on the prestige that we have the reliance that the families have in us. And this is one of the most, has been for since the beginning of time, one of the most grave violations of our code of our conduct codes and ethics.
Back to the list of treatments we had just discussed. I take it you don't prescribe any of those or suggest any of those to your patients?
No, ma'am.
Do you know if any of them are recommended by other neurologists within the American Academy of Pediatrics or other colleagues of yours in the field?
Well, I don't know them all. All the ones that that I know don't use these things. If we want to make ourselves feel better, sometimes we can bring these things up and have a little laugh about them. Then we think about the children that are unfortunately subjected to these things. So I don't know of anybody that does these things.
And the reason why you don't do them is because they don't work?
If I had anything I could do to help a child, I would do it.
I think you mentioned before that when you try a treatment on a child, you use just that one treatment at one time. Is that right?
It can be too confusing otherwise. There are times when we do more than one thing in a child with very significant epilepsy. We may double up on anti-seizure medications. There are times when we use more than one thing. But most of the time, especially in behavioral medicine, we need to be very careful about finding out what we're really doing.
I'd like to show you a statement from Dr. Green in a letter from Dr. Green to the Mead family. This is William Mead, Exhibit 5 at page 89. Dr. Green says, "In a sense, together we have to become masters of the multivariate analysis with multiple interventions infringing on him simultaneously or nearly simultaneously." What's your response to that statement?
Well, in the way I use the language, I'd say infringing is exactly the right word. We're infringing on this patient's opportunity to have carefully studied remedies and infringing on the opportunity of people to actually understand what in the world is going on. Medicine has been filled for centuries of potions and toxins and other kinds of things given to children and, or adults or other people for various reasons, oftentimes in association with strange ideas people have about the gut. These have almost universally been things that resulted in no improvement and that resulted probably in problems more than help.
Dr. Russ, you just mentioned the gut. Are gut or gastrointestinal issues something seen uniquely in the autistic population?
Everybody has gut problems. I guess it's what it is and how much of it they have. So the data would suggest that if you look carefully, maybe as many as 80% of children with autism have some kind of complaint related to the digestive system. But overwhelmingly, in my practice and in the data that's been most carefully gathered, that's at the top end of things, and that is the remarkable and so very uniform issue with regard to certain kinds of things that won't be eaten in under certain conditions.
Can you describe that a little bit more?
Food that's warm is allowed to go to room temperature, and food that's cold is allowed to melt and go to room temperature. As such a very frequent thing in autism. I don't understand why it is, but as I ask about it with other children in the clinic, I don't find the same thing. And so it does seem to be a feature that was peculiar to autism. There are food textures that are rejected. There are difficulties with oral medications sometimes that also are features at the top end of things. At the other end of things, we see particularly frequent diarrhea in some of our patients. Doesn't seem to be in association with abdominal pain or discomfort, but when looked into, what we find is that like some other children, but particularly in some children with autism, we see retention of large amounts of stool. The result of that, the detection of it, can be found in otherwise normal children, because they complain of discomfort. And then the investigation of the ensuing diarrhea, once you get a large amount of stool, the less formed liquid stools tend to traverse around that large amount of stool and be passed as what seems to be diarrhea. So you can, again, get a clue in normal children because they tell you about the discomfort they're experiencing. We don't get, for various reasons, some of which we know about, some of which we don't, the same complaint in individuals with autistic problems. What we find when we find it is that the same sort of thing is often there in the child that has frequent watery stools. And it's the same feature of overflow diarrhea around that large stool, producing many liquid stools over a long interval of time. It's a difficult problem to treat, but it can be treated, and it represents a frequently observed thing in our gastrointestinal clinic at our hospital. The other interesting feature about it is the feature of autistic individuals not complaining of pain. Now, in those that don't have language to complain of it, it's quite understandable. But we have these peculiar issues of pain intolerance or tolerance in autism that we also don't understand. So I have had a number of autistic children, children with autistic features, I should really say, that have had broken bones, and one doesn't find out until one looks very carefully. I've had children that have had severe falls and get right back up from them. And yet, on the other hand, a child can have a small cut with bleeding and become so upset that they sometimes can't be calmed very quickly, or the placement of a bandage on a cut or wound can't be tolerated sometimes. So there are sensory, unusual sensory features, and probably the prevalence of this gastrointestinal thing down below, stool retention, which is really only found in about 7 or 8% of children with autism, but recurs so much because of the flow around the stool that it does become a persistent problem with frequent stools.
All right, at this time we're going to move to discussion of Dr. Kinsborn's report. We can get back to your slideshow. Before we do that, though, I take it you've reviewed Dr. Kinsborn's report.
Yes, ma'am, I have.
What's your general reaction to Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis?
We are now on slide
55, I think, has some of your response, but just off the cuff.
I prefaced my account with the problems that we run into with deciding what the cause is in the first place and trying to fit the evidence to it. I've mentioned Tycho Brahe and trying to place everything around the Earth in the solar system. There's lots of this in medicine where people stick with a particular thing. And as I mentioned, one of the greatest figures in medicine and science, Oliver Lowry, said that when you hit on the right idea, it's bound, as it's been my experience ever since, to be something that is simple and elegant and unexpected, or usually unexpected. The hypotheses here are incredibly complex and awkward. They are, most of the data is either not representative of the papers that are cited as evidence, or there seems to be some distortion of the data. Other things are offered far ahead of the availability of any reliable data, so there's very meager data for these things. He's not to be faulted for the fact that there's meager data, because there isn't that much data, but there is more data than is cited, and the data that is not in keeping with the hypothesis is not cited. These kinds of hypotheses are relatively easy to put together. I don't know how this was put together, except to say that it's awkward. But sometimes we see in our medical students or in people putting together high school projects for science fairs that they'll go online and put a few words in there and come up with some connection and try to fit these things together in some way. One gets a feeling for this. But I don't know that he did it that way. The prominent countervailing data and theories are not considered. The idea, we know a great deal about the regulation and the interaction of the systems that are involved and referred to. And there's absolutely no apparent understanding of the ways in which the system actually functions. One example I already suggested, which is this absolutely necessary interaction between astrocytes and neurons, and the very complicated business of counter-regulation for excitatory compounds in the synapse, no real understanding of the architecture of the synapse, as far as I could tell. There's shifting reliance on one or another portion of the data, and shifting reliance. The one convenient thing about an awkward theory like this is that once you have the idea that there's either some special susceptibility or there is some way in which some particular thing can cause a problem that's never known to cause and hasn't been identified as causing pathologically, that you can substitute one thing for another. So we now have something that seems to be a substitution for prior suggestions by various people, I believe Dr. Kinsborn among them, that measles virus does this. That is an awkward hypothesis because we know exactly what measles encephalopathy looks like clinically and pathologically, and it's not autism. Supportive data seem to me to be taken out of context and seem many times to be impertinent to what's going on. It's that data selected to support the hypothesis.
Moving to slide 56, it appears you take issue with Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis about regression and his attempt to set progressive autism off from classic autism. Can you explain your thoughts
on that? It's an artificial distinction, except to say that in some children we see an emphasis on, parents tell us this and we believe them, we see an emphasis on something declining in the second year, but sometimes we get reports at variance with one another. But it's a small difference, and once we ask the questions that I mentioned to you, our former view that there was, in fact, this thing as a very discrete thing has really vanished because we find pre-regression abnormalities that I've already referred to. The one thing that made these things rather different from one another is when we used to include a variety of symptomatic autisms under this heading, some of which would fall into the classic group and some of which would fall into the regressive group. And once those were separated, the difference became also less distinct. As to whether there are more overt seizures in regressive autism, we don't actually know whether this is true. There are citations to this effect. What we do know is that we do more EEGs and we find more EEG abnormalities than we have recognized in younger children, but we don't do EEGs on our children that come to us with autism in the first year of life.
Dr. Rust, if you had, let's say, 2 6-year-old boys, one with what might be termed classic autism and one with what might be termed regressive autism, at the age of 6, are they going to clinically present any differently from one another?
They don't look any different to me. There's some variation in individuals, but they don't look any different to me. The other point about this seizures and regressive things is that overwhelmingly in my practice and that of others, seizures are not a feature of toxic conditions. Dysfunction is a feature of toxic conditions. When we see seizures and don't have an explanation, the first thing we look for is a developmental, genetically determined condition. What about this? Rickler is cited in that. There are not so many citations there. But he cites Rickler's paper about regressive autism, and this is to support the statement that there are more GI complaints in autism. In the same paper, Rickler says the majority of regressive ASD children had clearly atypical pre-loss development. This is an example of a piece of information. If you're citing a paper, you regard somebody as authoritative in one sense, you must regard them as authoritative in others. We don't have any reason to distinguish and pick and choose, but this is what we call cherry picking, which is sometimes an aspect, or usually an aspect of these kinds of hypotheses. So we need to respect the individual who's come up with something we think is important and listen to the rest they have to say, because it's usually evidence that they've looked very carefully. And the kinds of things that were found were social and verbal IQ and language problems. And that would seem to me to undermine the idea that the MMR vaccine is causing this combination of things.
The MMR vaccine or thimerosal containing?
Thimerosal containing, I'm sorry, any vaccine, really.
It does seem to be interchangeable.
Because, yeah, that's right.
Let's move now to slide 57. Your comments on the GI system.
Well, these are the kinds of data that are gathered in careful groups. Really, one of the leading groups in the world is Isabel Rapine's group. She's been interested in this since 1961 and has published extensively. And her data was what set me to thinking about these things and looking carefully at our children. And we find the same thing, the same amount of patients with GI problems, mostly problems from above, stool pattern abnormalities down below. I think we've stolen the march on Isabel. This is the only time I've known about doing this with her, with this idea about stool retention, which we've now found in so many. We're looking carefully into this in a prospective way.
Let me just ask Dr. Russ, I'm lost with the abbreviation 42% DD. Help me.
All right. Gastrointestinal problems, 70% of children with autistic spectrum disorders.
Understood.
Which includes, as the special master suggested earlier, a broader variety of individuals needs to be looked at more carefully in subgroups. But developmental delay, 42% have gastrointestinal problems. That's a high number. And of normal children, their control is 28%. So there are lots of children with gastrointestinal problems, lots of children that have ear infections, which are a nonspecific feature, not suggestive of vulnerability for autism. There's so many of those. But so many children get diarrhea as a result of being treated for ear infections, as so many children get thrush from being treated for ear infections. And then as they're treated because of the thrush resulting from antibiotics, they get some thrush down below, associated diarrhea, and it gets into a cycle that we frequently see as the explanation for children that have diarrhea in the setting of normality, developmental delay, or autism. And stool pattern abnormalities, Isabel's group found 18% in autistic spectrum disorders and 4% of controls. We've looked at our children and have found a slightly smaller number than that, about 7% of children with classic autism or regressive autism, which we can't readily distinguish from one another.
I'd like to move now to slide number 58. Where you appear to take issue with Dr. Kinsborn's statement that there was a previously normal developmental trajectory.
All right.
I think you've already somewhat explained that. But
I really have. This issue of increment needs to be better refined than this. He doesn't support it with things, it seemed to me this was set up for a particular purpose, that what we call a straw man. But if it's truly the fact that incremental changes occur, then one can't exclude the possibility that we find is a probability that children that have what appears to be a regression in the second year of life have had preceding manifestations of illness in the first year of life. So this seems to be used. I don't know. I can't get into his mind, but looking at the way in which the argument is set up, this seems to be support for the idea that there's some gradual and incremental aspect to retention of inorganic mercury in the in the brain.
Moving now to slide 59, the systems view of autism.
I think I've already referred to this a good deal, I think again the reason it's included here is that this is not represented in the formulation of the hypothesis. In this is the way in which most of us that see lots of children with autism or spend a good deal of our careers interested in this disorder to try to understand these things. And so, as I've mentioned already, because the hypothesis has to do with inflammation and intoxication, inflammation of a novel sort that we don't know about otherwise, and information about intoxication of a novel sort that we don't otherwise know about, that it doesn't take into consideration the fact that those conditions don't produce the kinds of injury, the kinds of abnormality, I should say, that involve these functional connections. Um, The fact that there are greater severity of early injury in autism is suggestive to us that during those early periods of brain development where so much is happening so rapidly, that that's when much more severe illness can present itself. Since there isn't any exposure to toxins at that point, it would suggest to us that, again, the likelihood is that the developmental aspect of the disease is what's going on here. Rapid periods of development are periods during which more severe disease presents itself, and subsequently lesser degrees of injury.
And what time are you talking about with regard to that second goal?
Intrauterine environment being the most severe interval for those things. And we have numerous examples of that.
Moving now to slide number 60. Autistic regression.
Well, I, again, this seems to be at variance with the idea that there is an incremental development of disease that was asserted earlier. It's at variance with what we really now know once we've been looking carefully about additional stages of deterioration in autism. And I mentioned in particular deterioration during the second decade of life, which is a very troublesome period for that. And certainly at variance with the hypothesis that then is developed later on that there is ongoing injury that represents itself not only in ongoing changes in the system, but an ongoing manifestation being the novel idea about hyperexcitability in the brain. He does say in the same paragraph that autism may become more severe. And that would seem to me also not to be self-limiting. And then there's the issue of if the regression is self-limiting, why it is that children might get benefit from chelation and other kinds of things if the injury has already been produced. There's a false assertion that the medical literature is almost devoid of attention to the mechanism of regression in autism. There is an enormous literature on this subject and considerable attention to understanding this very important disease and its results.
Moving now to slide number 61.
So there's an inaccurate statement that autistic regression is shocking. This seems to put a little emotional aspect in the particular paragraph. And that it can't be mistaken for mental retardation or developmental delay. This is considerably at variance with my own experience families do notice these things but wonder about them for some time oftentimes. These are not the sort of things, because families do notice things that would have been overlooked in the past. Families would either early or later have brought them to our attention. The differences that we see in these children, as I mentioned now, is a long list of things that we can ask about. There are things that were overlooked in the past. Nonetheless, the function of children with autism is something that we've known about for a long time. We've given it wrong labels in the past. This had to do in part with institutionalization. It had to do in considerable part with our inattention to these manifestations and our willingness to use labels inappropriately. We're far more sophisticated now. But it does, in my own personal experience and in the experience of many of us, and in my continued observations about clinicians who refer patients to me, to see that that we are labeling patients better than we used to. And many of us believe the seeming increase in numbers of cases of autism is related to our much increased ability to diagnose. Every year I diagnose many children with autism, as I mentioned, who have been overlooked by other clinicians as having a very obvious case of that condition.
Your last point there, you say that there's no reason to argue that the genetic explanation is inadequate and that therefore an environmental factor must be implicated. I want to ask you a little bit about differential diagnosis. If you're trying to figure out the cause of some type of disorder and you create a list, let's say with two items on it, and you're able to cross one of them off, does that mean that the one that's left on the list is the cause of the underlying disorder?
No, it certainly does. It sometimes does. We get lucky sometimes, and some diseases are pretty obvious to us. So the neurologists take great pride in making the smallest list possible. Once they've made the list, they don't just sit back and put it on the wall. They test for it. It's our pride that sometimes we can say something right off the bat. It's not as if other people haven't noticed, especially in autism. When I see a child based on a few quick observations, placing my hand on the head of the child, then ask a few more questions and diagnose autism, been through three physicians or four physicians, and I ask mother, you knew this was autism, didn't you? And she says, yes, she did. So the mothers sometimes know, and we sometimes know because of certain clues. But if we have an idea about something, it's our obligation then to test for it. And for all those things that we have tests, we go ahead and do it. Some make long lists for these tests, and some make short lists. But we don't have an explanation for many conditions. There are lots of things that we deal with every day. We don't know what causes most cerebral palsy. We don't know what causes 85% of mental retardation. That doesn't stop for us looking for those things, and it doesn't cause us to conclude that we can make something up on the spot and say that causes all of them.
Let's move now to slide number 82. I'm sorry, 62.
All right. The citation of Rutter is used to support the suggestion that awareness and changing criteria cannot account for anything like the actual rise of autism rates. What he actually says is available data, mostly prevalence, few of incidents, but no good evidence that the overall rates have soared. So this is a distinction between knowing what the real incidence of a disease is and knowing what the prevalence in our own populations based on what we recognize as a disease is. And now we recognize more and more of it. So actually, we get closer to the idea of what the incidence is, and that incidence is higher not because the disease is increasing, most of us believe. Still requires some more proof. This has to be further refined, as all hypotheses do, but the evidence, as we look at it, favors this, that that the incidence is higher than we thought it was because we didn't look carefully enough. If you look at a population and a country, I don't know why the Swedes do such good medicine. Maybe it's long winters and nothing else to do. But they look at their diseases so carefully, and only a 1% rise in the incidence of autism in the Swedish population since the 1970 data. They have some of the best data on these kinds of things. We do have an increase in autism diagnosis as a symptomatic variety, and that's related to the only very recently recognized fact that our children with severe prematurity have autism as well. It's one of the other features. They also have motor disease and other things, but definitely have features that are those that we look for in autism. It's a symptomatic variety, and because we have more children that survive severe prematurity, we see more of that neurologically handicapping condition.
Let's move now to slide number 63. Your critique of Dr. Kinsborn's citation of the Herbert article.
Yeah, the cited source seems to take a pretty balanced view and says that autism is a neurobiologically based and highly genetic condition entailing the action of environmentally responsive genes. Emphasis is placed in the review on the fact that 135 genes are involved with regions pertinent to autism and remain to be evaluated as possible causes, and the statement that is important to consider the gene-environment interactions as a possibility did not lead to the conclusion that a particular environmental influence would be found to cause autism. It's quite incorrect for Dr. Kinsborn to state that in many individuals with autism there is no viable alternative diagnostic option other than the involvement of a postnatal environmental insult. This is not true at all, I can say based on my experience, and would suggest
the possibility, I don't know the truth of it, that perhaps he doesn't see many children with autism. The same could be said of other processes now known to be entirely genetic, such as Rett syndrome. And again, the original idea that lasted for some time that this was caused by ammonia intoxication based on a faulty lab result, based on not testing the hypothesis, and based on the satisfaction with ease of coming to the conclusion about what causes what.
Let's move now to slide number 64, where you discuss Dr. Kinsborn's explanation of inorganic mercury.
And he says that it's a cause, at this point, that it's caused by, I think there have been prior views, it's caused by inorganic mercury breakdown, a breakdown into inorganic mercury. If this is the case, since ethyl mercury also breaks down, and we know what ethyl mercury looks like when it's in sufficient quantities to cause injury, we know that it takes a very considerable quantity to do that, as I've suggested in the concentration that occurs in the fetus.
And you're talking about methyl mercury?
I'm sorry, methyl mercury. Did I say ethyl?
I think you did.
I'm terribly sorry. With methyl mercury, we know what that looks like. It takes a considerable amount, as I mentioned, concentrated in the fetus, preferentially, unfortunately. But once you get that amount, we know what that looks like. It breaks down into inorganic mercury, and the changes or differences between these compounds at various concentrations, I would not think, we don't know this for sure because it's not been carefully studied, would not produce different forms of injury, because sensitivities should be the same for inorganic mercury. It needs to be tested as well. The hypothesis that an immune response somehow changes this pathology is a novel one for which there's no information that I'm aware of, and I looked very hard to see whether that's the case. Then assessed the ideas about the immune response itself, found that there was no support for this novel hypothesis, which, as I recall, Dr. Kinsborn takes credit for, and the suggestion of subacute ongoing injury, once he gets into this portion of the discussion, seems to me completely at variance with the idea that there's a shocking suddenness and a self-limiting aspect to autism.
We'll move now to slide 65, which is titled Glial Cells in the Brain. Dr. Russ, have you published anything on astrocytes in the past?
Yes, I have. These were an old interest of mine, in particular, the developmental aspects of astrocytes, what their functions were, how they worked biochemically, what they did in relationship to other cells in the brain, and this was particularly in relationship to neurons. To oligodendroglial cells, which have remarkably interesting relationships in the developing brain that I've already referred to in part.
Does Dr. Kinsborn's characterization of astrocytic and microglial changes in the brain, is that consistent with what you know about it?
Not at all, nor is it consistent with what I know about inflammation. Inflammation, inflammatory illnesses in the central nervous system have been a preoccupation of mine since the mid-80s. I've collected some of the largest collections of the known inflammatory diseases of children and both speak on this subject and publish on this subject. And it's a difficult one, but we know a good deal about how these conditions behave both clinically and pathologically. And we know, again, increasing amounts about what astroglial cells, whether astrocytes or microglial cells, do both in inflammation, in brain injury, and in, and now this this recent and very interesting business that's related to the function of these cells in brain development. So if you have injury, such as you have with methyl mercury, then microglial cells appear in order to clean up the injured cells. They do that regularly. They do that in inflammatory conditions as well. We don't fully understand microglial cells. There's still a lot of mystery tied up in them, and there's still lots of things to study about them. So this novel idea is one that somebody might choose to do experiments to prove. Perhaps Dr. Kinsborn would be interested. And one of the many explanations for the presence of microglia found in the Well, it's a novel idea is what I'm trying to say here. There is increasing evidence of the presence of inflammatory cells as a very important and normal element of brain development in terms of how the brain develops. And perhaps Dr. Kemper, who knows much more about that than I do, will say something about it.
Perhaps he will. Let's move on to page or slide number 66. I think this appears to be sort of a general response that you have to Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis. What about this is striking to you?
Well, he cites in support of sustained neuroinflammation the paper of Bezzani and Granata. This is work that was carried on in an entirely different setting, one that we understand in an entirely different way, and for which we've had information since the late 1970s. This has nothing to do with mercury. It has nothing to do with autism. And what this has to do with is what we now understand very well about the experimental, about the natural activities demonstrated experimentally in terms of the development of an epileptic focus. Again, something that has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. So their work isn't in any way applicable to what's going on here. What we know about is that if you stimulate particularly susceptible cells in the hippocampus, this is originally the work of Tom Satula, who was trained at my institution. If you, for a long period of time, provide an external stimulus to neurons, and so you do this by placing a wire and providing a regular pulse of current. This is not because neurons have decided somehow to take it on themselves to have impulses, because, as I've mentioned, there's so many exquisite regulatory mechanisms that prevent that, and they're so able and so redundant that you have to do this over and over again, this stimulus, before you can cause them to begin to break down and produce a state where the control mechanisms don't work as well, and you can produce an epileptic focus, and that's what Bezzani and Granata are talking about. So there's external stimulus, not exogenous stimulus. And so as a, you know, it just takes your breath away to think about how this is being applied here. It's ignored that that their conclusion is that the changes are related to genetic transcriptional activation, which exactly is what has come to be understood in this experimental model. So it's the turning on and turning off of genes here once again. The tissue injury occurs, and the subsequent work by Dr. Dichter in Philadelphia and others has shown that this regional injury in very susceptible tissue with a very special circumstance, not of neurons taking it upon themselves to be excited, but stimulating them over and over again with the noxious stimulus, is the failure to control highly specific difficulties in elevations of potassium. You can injure the region with excitatory amino acids as well, which is something that Dr. Kinsborn seems to refer to vaguely. But this is a particular thing that has a particular genetic and particular biochemical abnormalities. It's required 30 years of work, 30 years of work, isn't that something, for this to actually work its way out to be understood. And it's because people, you know, when Tom Satula had the initial idea, lots of people thought that this was a silly idea too. So I suppose they might say that about Dr. Kinsborn's ideas here. Perhaps I would. But but it takes work to prove these things. You can't just go out and say, I think this is a pretty good idea. And it took 10 years for Tom Satula to demonstrate what was going on. And the result of that was generating the data that I've already cited about long loop connections, because epilepsy, when it arises, is one of those examples as well. It doesn't reach any conclusion at all about whether the presence of cells associated with inflammatory responses, to make a point of this, is beneficial or deleterious.
Let's move on now to slide number 67, where Dr. Kinsborn stated that there's dramatic support for his hypothesis.
Well, he cites Bailey, and they identify gliosis in brains of individuals with autism. This is a nonspecific finding. Now, again, it's something about which Dr. Kemper knows a great deal more than I do, and so perhaps I shouldn't go into it, but I know that in brain diseases in particular of a broad variety, we see these, especially in some conditions that arise from a genetic vantage point. The paper says that the cause and time of onset of autism is not known, and that the finding of gliosis was an inconsistent finding, and that the cause of gliosis and brain damage was unspecified, and brain damage, gliosis and brain damage, and it is specifically stated that the findings cannot be assigned to any specific possible causative event or process. This seems to me a balanced view and cannot, in my view, be regarded as anything like dramatic support for this novel combination of toxins and inflammation as a cause of autism. They don't discuss anything about that at all.
Let's move now to slide number 68 with the Hurtado.
There's this paper by Lopez Hurtado and Prieto. Only some parts of the brain are studied, and again, Dr. Kemper knows so much more about this than I do. So particular areas, these are speech areas, were looked at, and there was some focally increased density of glial cells noted in association with decrease in neuron density in a particular area, and lipofuscin was present there, which is a pretty nonspecific thing, and these were individuals with autism. He states that the age of the individuals is 7 to 44 years of age, which is interesting. I don't know whether the paper tells us that there's any difference in the amount of lipofuscin or the gliosis over those ages. I don't know the answer to that. But we know that lipofuscin, which can be found in the brains of otherwise normal individuals, gradually may increase as an aspect of growth and development for reasons that aren't clear. 44-year-old individual is quite interesting, I think, because...
Let's move to the next slide with your concerns with that.
Where did he get thimerosal from?
Slide number 69.
We don't know exactly when he died, but one can gather from the paper somewhere in the early 60s. So where did his thimerosal come from if he has these changes? Where did his vaccines come from? We had very few back then. Most were not invented at that point. We had tetanus and things like that. As I mentioned, lipofuscin is nonspecific. The changes were most striking, and this is in the paper, not Dr. Kinsmore's use of the word, in layers 2, 3, 5, and 6, which is interesting relationship to Rett syndrome and genetically determined cause of autistic syndrome. And similar changes are seen in Down syndrome. They're seen in Alzheimer and Parkinson's disease that likely have, at least in part, a genetic basis, and schizophrenia, which has some clinical overlap.
Move now to slide number 70, the Friedman citation.
The following paragraph, this is Dr. Friedman and his group, says they've demonstrated ongoing active disease in the cerebral gray matter of individuals with autism.
Can you slow down a little bit, doctor?
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. My students tell me I do that too.
Especially when you read word for word from the slide, you're going pretty fast.
Yes, sir. I'll try my best. Remind me again, please, sir. Ongoing active disease in the gray matter of individuals with autism. There should be another quotation marks there. To the contrary, to my reading, these are indirect imaging studies, in fact, something with which I'm quite familiar. They say that there is possible decreased cellularity. They don't tell us about ongoing active disease in gray matter, and this is consistent with, as they put it, delay in neuronal development or maturation. That's something quite different from what is said in the report. They concluded that autism manifested, and this is their quote, abnormal developmental processes. And they say nothing more than that by my reading.
Let's move now to slide number 71.
Okay,
the Vargas and Pardo citation.
Yes, the paper, the work of Drs. Vargas and Pardo, I think that they're with the Hopkins group, concerning evidence of microglial and astroglial activation, something, again, that's very new in this area, except in certain kinds of diseases, a broad variety we know a lot about, but
The implication seems to be that Dr. Pardo notes that long-standing inflammatory changes occurred in the setting. Of other neurodevelopmental abnormalities, probably as part of an active plastic response without any decrease in astrocytes. To the contrary, the staining here is with GFAP, which is a marker for astrocytes, and showed that they were increased. And he concluded that these findings are inconsistent with a potential toxic effect on astrocytes by neurotoxins or a toxic material. The reason for that is if you have intoxication and it kills or maims astrocytes, you're going to see a decline in GFAP, the marker for astrocytes. He properly emphasizes the innate wing of the neuroinflammatory response is not associated with infiltration of activated T or B cells, which would seem to be the kind of process that Dr. Kinsborn is meaning to refer to.
Now, Dr. Rust, have you read the letter that Dr. Pardo wrote to Dr. Kemper?
I did.
Okay. Is that included in the slide on slide number 71? Is that what you're referring
yes,
to with Dr. Pardo's note?
Okay. Whether at this point it came from the paper or from the letter, I actually can't recall.
Okay. Let's move to 72. It's a continued discussion of that letter, or of the Pardo group's work.
He says there are a suite. I don't know what that is, but I suppose a group of elevated pro-inflammatory cytokine levels in CSF, and he says that this is evidence of brain inflammation. This is a very, very complicated subject, and it needs to be addressed very carefully. There is balance between cytokines in the nervous system. Some are pro and some are anti-inflammatory. These cytokines serve a number of different functions. And these include not only inflammatory diseases, but likely aspects of normal brain development, as I've implied. So they are important, actually, neurobiologically, in normal brain homeostasis, and not necessarily representative of a condition that's causing inflammation. We find these not only in the brain, but elsewhere in the body. It's easy for us sometimes if we do a large look for either antibodies or cytokines of various sorts to find these in a broad variety of diseases, and we sometimes don't understand whether they're positive or negative. So Dr. Pardo appears to be well aware of the homeostatic functions of cytokines and chemokines and mentions these and makes it clear that his studies do not confirm a toxic inflammatory basis for any of his observations or that they represent any deleterious process, but they could as well represent a non-specific process of repair.
And I believe
that's from the letter.
Okay. I believe on slide 73, you seem to summarize the same idea there.
So there's abundant evidence of the presence not only of cytokines and chemokines, but of specific antibodies in brain tissue and CSF in a broad variety of neurological conditions that we know to be genetically determined. Rett syndrome being one among them that's very important here. Tuberous sclerosis as well, and other conditions such as Parkinson's disease. So in those conditions where we don't recognize anything to do with inflammation or intoxication, we have to think about these things as serving some other function. And whether positive or negative, we don't know.
Moving now to slide number 74.
So the basic argument doesn't seem to be very helpful. He turns to Ashner's hypothesis of astrocytic injury as the source for neuronal injury or neuronal dysfunction. This is an intermediate step in the pathophysiology of autism. So somehow the fact that the astrocytes appreciating, perhaps as I do, their importance to the neurons, once they begin to fail in their function, that the neurons begin to do things on their own. So Dr. Ashner's work, I don't know fully. I do know his work on manganese toxicity in mitochondria, which, as far as I know, is not relevant to what we're talking about here. I didn't have the opportunity to see the report for very long from Dr. Kinsborn, but was unable to find the paper cited from the Brazilian Journal of
medical and biological research with regard to the argument, so I don't know what that says. So with some trepidation, as I suggest, I base my comments on Dr. Kinsborn's interpretation. He seems to be implying an effect of glutamine. He says glutamine. Now, whether that's just a misstatement or not, there's another misstatement apparently with regard to pyramidal cells and Purkinje cells. So this may have slip of a pen. I'm known to do them myself, and all of us are. Glutamine is a non-toxic substance. It's put into the region of the neuron, so it can be taken up and changed into glutamate. Maybe I'll show that. I want to show a little bit of my own work, but I'll go through it quickly, I hope, so that I won't take up too much of your time. But this hypothesis is one that has, I think, lethal problems in terms of scientific support. There is some basis of this on the article by Betsy and others that astrocytic cell... Can I go back?
And this is...
That astrocytic cell death is the cause of the ensuing neuronal dysfunction, and afterwards sustained for long-term hyperexcited neuronal state, which again is at variance with the idea of all at once and nothing first and no ensuing development of autism.
So, slide 75 is a little more specific to the Betsy article.
Okay. As he reads the experimental conditions in the Betsy experiment, as in almost all studies, as I mentioned, of viable neurons, you have to have healthy astrocytes to have neurons in the first place. There are only very special circumstances where you can have neurons in isolation. The injury here is not produced by chronic inflammation at all. It's produced by the introduction of freshly activated microglial cells. This is a very important thing for us to know about, because we know about the very important thing of what we call bystander injury. Once you produce a specific response of some sort, you can produce bystander injury once you activate the immune system in a particular way. And therefore, you can injure cells that were not initially implicated. Whether this is what's going on here, we don't know for sure, because additional work is necessary. The third and final point that I want to make is that the endpoint in this experiment wasn't glial injury. The endpoint was neuronal hyperexcitation. It wasn't glial injury, and it wasn't neuronal hyperexcitation with the proposed idea of glutamate flow, and I don't know what that is, but it was neuronal cell death. And then I ask why this might have occurred.
So if there were a chronic astrocyte malfunction or astrocyte death that would cause the death of the neuron, is that what you're saying?
Well, I can show you the reasons why that might happen.
In the following slides? Okay. To the extent we can minimize the observation of these, we'll try to do that. But number 76 is the slide we're on now.
Yeah, this is the part of the interaction, and this is the interaction that involves glutamate and glutamine. It's highly regulated, both at the level of the neuron and at the astrocyte, and it's intended to provide the precursor for glutamate. If the neuron becomes exposed to too much glutamate or contains too much glutamate, the process shuts down, and it's in the way of glutamine being uptaken by the neuron. There is some emerging evidence, but very preliminary evidence, about what happens in terms of the glutamate pore. There probably is also a highly regulated situation in the astrocyte as far as release of glutamate, but it's much too early to know how pertinent that is to the proposed model of disease here.
Does it seem to you that Dr. Kinsborn is focusing on the glutamate kind of in isolation without regard to the rest of the system?
Well, he doesn't mention any of the rest of the system, if that's what you mean.
Okay. The next slide, is that important to your discussion here?
Well, this is what I mentioned about the astrocytes, and this is astrocytes early on are loaded with glycogen, which is a source of glucose. We know during that interval, we have very good reason to believe, I should say, no is perhaps too strong a word, but the evidence is very strong that the presence of this energy resource serves several different purposes. One is producing intermediates for growth and development of the brain, and the other is glucose to support cells that don't have the capacity that astrocytes do to accumulate and utilize this primary source of energy in brain, glucose.
Slide 78. What are we looking at here? Yeah.
Well, there was mention of the sheathing that occurs with the astrocyte and the neuron. This is also a very important and new area that's progressing very rapidly. And these are synapses these are artist conceptions. But the information is very strong and supportive of these things. And with regard to the functional elements that I'll mention, it's proven. So one interesting thing is that what we now, many people call the neural synapse, and this is, we know about the synapse, but many people call the immune synapse, which is the communication between immune cells. We've always known that at least two or three different immune cells talk to each other in producing an immune response, but there is increasingly abundant evidence that this very closely resembles what we call the neural synapse. At least implying in a way that is a little loose, and so I'll acknowledge that, that there may have been a very primitive association between immune things and neurologic things, and perhaps that's why the systems we're beginning to appreciate have so much to do with one another. But nonetheless, what's shown here, if you look at the neural synapse, is that the attachment between two cells at the synapse, this is where the glutamate finds its way to communicate between cells, is tightly connected with adhesion molecules but between the two neurological elements. Small amounts of glutamate can be released in this region, and those small amounts of glutamate produce exquisite signals. The receiving cell of this signal can dial up or dial down the sensitivity to this glutamate. If there's too much glutamate, it dials way down. It loses receptors, and it doesn't remake them and push them back to the surface. So this is a dynamic system that the point is it's highly regulated. It is possible to injure it, but not so far as we know because of glutamate necessarily floating from some other cells that happen to be in the vicinity. The usual idea here is this has to do with this tightly regulated and enclosed neural synapse. And again, the same thing appears to be true with regard to the very same kinds of exquisite regulation to the immune synapse, which is meant to bring to mind to us that the immune system very highly regulates itself, whether it's with inflammation or whether it's with the normal developmental functions or whether it's in terms of cleaning up after some injury that it performs in the nervous system.
Dr. S., you may have already gone over this, but if there were to be too much glutamate released from the end of the cell, what would be expected as regards to the neuron?
The exquisite part of this is the GABA regulation, down-regulation that occurs so that you limit the amount of glutamate released at that point. And so there's inhibition, and it comes in several different kinds. There's long-term and short-term and other things that happen. But this is involved in learning, and it's involved in normal function of the nervous system and development. And it's highly regulated, and it's regulated at the level of the astrocyte as well, although that's an area about which we know somewhat less than we know about neurons at this point.
If that regulating system were not in place and there was too much glutamate, would that cause the neuron to die?
Yes, and again, it takes a long time to do that. As I mentioned from this Satula model and others, you have to stay at it and stay at it to cause the remodeling to produce an epileptic situation. But that's right.
Do you agree with Dr. Kinsborn's statement that autistic behavior is precisely what one would expect if the brain's excitation-inhibition ratio were skewed in favor of excitation, as occurs in hyperglutamatergic states? Do you agree with that statement?
Well, I'd have to know more about what he means by that. It's a rather general statement. It seems to be applied to the notion that children with autism have manifestations of a hyperexcitable state. At least that's what I recall.
And I don't know that this is true at all. And I mentioned we've got to be very careful about what we conclude about what children with autism are doing. And so I think that's a problem. But I would go on to say that if he's referring to the fact that the GABAergic side of things is having problems, which we know happens in Rett syndrome and may well happen in autism because the systems that are involve GABA, then maybe that's something. It needs to be tested. But nothing to do with the leak of glutamate or the flow of glutamate that I'm aware of. What that does is produce injury. The most active cells will then be injured and die.
Now, if Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis were true, would you expect the deficit seen in an autistic patient to get progressively worse over time based on his model?
Yes, because the only way we understand that model as working would be if we're causing hyperexcitation over long intervals of time, then that's the sort of thing that the Satula model involves. And what that does is remodel things to produce epilepsy, or it kills cells, one or the other. So what we would expect to see happening, as we see in epilepsy, for example, where hyperexcitability is an issue, we see progressive tissue injury. And what that produces is changes in motor function, changes in intellectual functions, changes in other functions that the brain is intended to do, and the production of worsening epilepsy. So, that's not what we see in autism. We do see some progressive issues with regard to EEG changes and epilepsy. We don't understand those things yet, and we don't know whether they have anything to do with this hypothesis. But if we see that sort of worsening in other situations, which we do see in a variety of epilepsies, what we call them epilepsy partialis continua, because of the continuous hyperexcitability, what we see absolutely in those cases is progressive injury to the brain. A nonspecific sort of regional injury is the typical thing that we see, and we don't see that in autism. Injury that does neighborhood injury, injury that produces clinical signs, which are motor and intellectual signs, and we don't see that in autism.
Ms. Esposito, let me ask. I'm getting the eyeball that suggests that we might be getting close to the hour we had designated to break. Are you at a point that's a natural breaking point?
I'm very close to it.
Okay.
Yes.
We could perhaps just break now and then come back briefly, and that way that some of these slides that may not be referred to, we can determine that. So I think this is probably a natural breaking point.
Having decided that this is now a natural breaking point, we are going to break. Let me ask if we want to do a compromise 45-minute lunch break, or if we want the entire hour, not knowing how much longer direct is to go and wanting to improve it.
I think direct is probably going to be very brief when we get back.
Okay. Is that a move in favor of it? And full hour?
Of the full hour, yes. I really appreciate that.
Okay. All right. Then we are in recess till 2:45.